nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, here we go to our second show this morning. And it is April 20, 2020. And it's the third Monday of the month. And on the third Monday, we are very honored to have Dr. Ray Peet with us. He has a PhD, University of Oregon. He specialized in physiology, started his work with hormones back 50 years ago, 1968. That's the year I started in radio. 68. Wow. Wrote his dissertation in 72, in which we outlined his ideas on progesterone and hormones. And his main thesis is that energy and structure are interdependent at every level. He has a newsletter that you can, we always give you a link there. You can click and get Dr. Peet's newsletter. And a quick reminder before we say hello is that Boyd Haley, former professor, emeritus, University of Kentucky, probably knows more about mercury than anybody on the planet a lot. He's going to be here tomorrow. And also Stephanie Seneff, she wants to talk about some of the potential connections between glyphosates as an insult on the body and this whole corona thing. So Stephanie Seneff and Dr. Boyd Haley on mercury and such will be here tomorrow. We'll start around 9 o'clock. We generally take off Tuesdays, but sometimes we just have a lot to do. And all about the Civil War and the Federal Reserve on Wednesday I think you'll find a fascinating fellow. Let's say hi up in Eugene, Oregon to Dr. Ray Peet. Good morning, Dr. Peet.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Very well.
Very well. Are things in Eugene, are they open and people bustling around, or what are they doing?
Yeah, the stores are starting to get the shelves stocked again.
Uh-huh.
And things are getting back towards normal.
Mm-hmm. Well, my friend, are you getting tired of answering emails about this corona thing? And what's your experience been with the people that you talk to?
People keep sending me interesting things.
It's like me. I sent you. Yeah.
Most recent was a woman, I think, in New York City giving her version of the sickness. She was treated with acetazolamide called Diamox for her particular problems, and reasoning from her experience, she came up with the same perceptions that a doctor in Brooklyn had noticed, and then another doctor in New York City gave his similar perspective, and this woman with apparently no medical background, just by her simple medical experience, worked the whole thing out in ways that it seems the CDC and World Health Organization might never get to, because it's based on a very cheap, simple drug and procedures that would actually save tremendous amount of money by avoiding the intubation and ventilation of patients. They've been noticing that something like an 80% mortality once they get on a ventilator, they are very unlikely to come off.
Really? Yeah. Alive. We've heard a little bit about that. Give us what you understand is going on when they put people on ventilators, Dr. Peet.
The stabilizing factor, it's been known for about 70 or 80 years that pure oxygen displaces carbon dioxide from the lung tissue as well as the rest of the body. And it injures the lung tissue to overventilate it by driving off the carbon dioxide. And when you lower the carbon dioxide systemically, it's replaced by an overproduction of lactic acid, and lactic acid shifts the metabolism and energy and pH and structure of the cells, making them swell up and block the passage of oxygen. So you plug up the lungs very quickly when you overventilate them. And if a person has slow metabolism and isn't producing very much CO2, it's very easy to get them into the hyperventilated lung-inflamed condition. Those are the people who, when they travel to 8 or 10,000 feet altitude too fast, develop edema of the lungs and brain. And people have started noticing that the people on ventilators behave the same as people with high altitude sickness.
Interesting.
And that has been treated for years. First, with this drug that makes the body retain more carbon dioxide, and then a few people noticed that giving a supplement carrying a tank of carbon dioxide up the mountain is more valuable than just oxygen. And a product has been available to hospitals since the late 1930s, I think, containing 5% carbon dioxide with 95% oxygen, which is vastly safer than pure oxygen for ventilating people. But hospitals have rejected it because of mistaken understanding about what carbon dioxide is. They think of it as a toxic gas rather than an inflammatory protective part of our metabolism.
So you're seeing doctors, I've seen a couple of the videos that are conjecturing that this is what's going on. I saw another doc, two of them, that were saying that they don't know what's going on, but they're seeing what their experience is, and they're virologists, and they're saying whatever's going on in the lungs, it is not a viral infection in the lungs. There's something else going on.
And people who try to explain the virus as the only cause, naturally, the fact that 80 or 90% of the people who have the demonstrated viral material in their bodies have no symptoms whatsoever. So obviously it isn't enough of a cause to cause them to have symptoms. And some of the people who have the symptoms have traditionally, going back as far as they've studied viruses, only about half of the people have an identifiable agent. So there are people with the sickness without the virus, and lots and lots of people with the virus with no sickness at all. So the idea of causality is a sort of a weak probability, not a straight causal thing.
Right, which is demonstrated by the video we put on our website this morning, Dr. Pete, the latest one by this fellow Kaufman, and he spells out this whole thing about Koch's postulates that you need to prove that something is a causation. Is that true?
Yeah, but science really isn't about proving things. Medicine, even less, hardly makes a gesture towards science. That's a gesture. But science is about trying to make clear the likelihood of your guess. You always have to describe in terms of the probability. The P factor has to be less than one chance in 20 that your results happened merely by chance. So good science recognizes that it's only a probability, and the less likely it is to have happened by chance, the more probable it's true. But the medicine has tried to turn science into saying that this guess is the absolute cause. In the hands of the CDC, that has given basically a slanderous view of what science is. It makes people deny that science has any place because they have basically said one thing publicly while being on record saying opposite things in private.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you know the forces behind wanting to get all these people on ventilators, which people, and you're agreeing, is actually causing more of a problem?
Carbon dioxide is our basic stabilizing anti-inflammatory material, and they aren't looking at it as anything but a toxic gas. When you're under stress, you start making lactic acid in excess, and they aren't paying enough attention to measuring the amount of lactate in the blood because lactate neutralizes the anti-inflammatory effect of carbon dioxide and creates inflammation even in the presence of a normally protective amount of CO2. And overventilation will easily drive up the lactic acid, making it look like they're becoming hypoxic. They interpret lactic acid as evidence of lack of oxygen, but that has been well established in shock, for example. Toxic factors or traumatic factors, whatever it is causing the injury, send signals to shift your cells into making lactic acid even in the presence of enough oxygen. So it's a very horrible mistake to take the presence of lactic acid as needing more oxygen. It can be the evidence of overventilation rather than underventilation.
Mm. So when they give folks that go into the hospital or nursing homes oxygen, are they giving them pure, or isn't there some CO2 mixed in there?
They have the product available, 5% CO2.
Right.
But I think only a couple of percent of institutions are willing to use that. But if they give just a dribble of oxygen into a cannula in your nostril, that often is harmless and helpful. It makes it a little easier to breathe, and they aren't giving so much oxygen that it's irritating their lungs.
Oh, I see. So that's why... I think in the nursing home, and when my mom was in a nursing home, they had her like 1 or 2 milliliters per minute or something, very low.
Is that right? That's helpful.
Yeah, but so that doesn't damage anything unless you really blast it with pure oxygen?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
And people are now saying that when that's done in hospitals, that they have approximately 100% survival instead of 80% mortality, or 60% to 80% mortality of the ventilated people.
Yeah. Very interesting. So we've done some shows, you know, and then you look at... So when you look at Kaufman's work that we put on the website, and he's going through like the SARS thing in 2003 on the journal Nature, and he shows where they didn't prove anything. And although the headline says Koch's postulates fulfilled for SARS virus, right? But then he'll go through, and throughout the article, they say that it was modified by Rivers for viral diseases. So I'm kind of still confused. Has anybody ever really proved that some virus out there floating around is causing a problem, has been isolated, and fulfills Koch's postulates and causative of a disease?
You remember Peter Duisberg?
You mentioned him, yeah.
HIV. He came close to proving what Andrew Kaufman is saying. Duisberg showed very convincing evidence that the actual cases of AIDS can be explained by demonstrated use of drugs, or in Africa, the harm done by other sicknesses and the drugs to treat them. Duisberg argued that the virus is harmless, and that the treatment or the recreational drugs will fully account for the disease. In the case of rhinovirus, the common cold germ, and the common coronavirus, until the last year or so, the coronavirus was one of the common cold agents. And even with the common cold virus, it was very hard to demonstrate transmission from a person.
Yes.
With about half of the people with the cold symptoms had neither coronavirus nor rhinovirus. Nothing could be demonstrated, but when they did have the virus, they would take a swab of it and put it in someone's nose, or grow it in human cells from the nasal membranes, and then put a concentrate of it. And even then, it wasn't an all or nothing. It would only take in certain people. So there was a degree of causability, but it wasn't it wasn't adequate in itself to cause it, because it took some property of the person who was susceptible to a cold. They would put 10 or 20 people in a room together all day, and often they couldn't catch a cold from a person with the cold. So even the cold is, you can't say it's the cause, but it's one of the causes.
Mm-hmm. So,
and the people who are susceptible, I think, really explain how the virus fits into the disease. It can be a part of the flu-like sickness, but the flu season happens because people are indoors during the winter months, experiencing a very different environment, not getting sun exposure, and having a relatively dry atmosphere that makes their nasal membranes sensitive. And so these germs are one of the things, but many others can contribute to the flu season sickness.
Yeah. And then I guess even severe weather changes can, right?
Dry weather. In dry weather, the air becomes literally heavier. And so you're one of the factors in dry weather, not only the membranes dry up, but the oxygen tension increases. And oxygen, by displacing carbon dioxide in these susceptible people who aren't metabolizing and producing lots of carbon dioxide, they are sensitive even to these increased pressure changes that will decrease their membrane carbon dioxide content and shift them over into inflammation. The people who see that the medical people, especially the government propaganda, it implies that the presence of the virus is causing somehow these symptoms. But it's been demonstrated that, for example, with the standard flu virus, if you give them a big dose of niacinamide, the symptoms won't occur, but the virus will still be there. So the virus replicating isn't causing the symptoms. The ability to produce inflammation is causing the symptoms, and the virus is just one of the factors letting that go. So the theory of causality by replication just doesn't make sense. It's the fact that this particular virus attacks an enzyme on cells. This enzyme is the anti-inflammatory factor, which is one of the factors affected by the virus. It inactivates ACE2 enzyme, which is the detoxifying agent to remove angiotensin. Hmm. And angiotensin activates the whole inflammatory defensive system and will account for all of the symptoms. Fever, secretion, edema, all of the known symptoms are relieved when you can block angiotensin.
Fascinating. I recall even back in the Jane Austen days, right, that they knew that, sometimes the delicate women, for example, would be exposed to a lot of cold, and they'd get sick. And they just kind of knew that was, the reasons. They would have the flu, but they never talked about them catching something from someone. They kind of understood, that that's part of the deal.
There was a study of, I think, about 250 women who recently gave birth in New York hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially none of them got sick. Some of them, a very large proportion of them, had the demonstrable virus evidence in their bodies, but none of them got seriously sick, showing that healthy young women it definitely isn't enough to cause the flu symptoms.
Isn't enough. Wow. Dr. Ray Peters with us, Patrick Timpone, One Radio Network.com. So on the whole CO2 thing, I guess that would be somewhat of an argument then when we exercise, we produce more CO2?
Too much exercise.
Too much.
You
get
drive
too much.
You produce lactic acid and drive your CO2 down.
Mm-hmm.
That's what overtraining is.
I see.
And if your metabolism is very high, you can tolerate more activity without stress and lactic acid.
Yeah. How would you know if you're doing too much?
It takes you longer to catch your breath.
Okay. All right. So as long as we're not breathing heavily, we're in good shape?
If you only breathe hard and have a high heart rate for a couple of minutes after exercise.
I see. And if it goes back down, then you're doing okay. You're making things stronger, right?
Yeah.
How can modern medicine have this all backwards?
It took a long investment of the pharmaceutical industry. Driving research, it really got its start in the 1940s. The drug industry learned that it could control the FDA when it convinced them to approve estrogen to treat menopause.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
They ran the university research, the FDA regulators, and the public opinion. And it has they've added their various drugs to the system. Now they can use the system just as a giant marketing tool.
Yeah, which I guess it all ties in with the WHO and CDC and that whole crowd, right? The people that meet and sit together.
And the vaccines,
of course,
being financed by the government, it's now tens of billions of dollars a year profit in vaccines, and so there's no incentive to finish off a disease the way they did with a relatively very low cost. They eliminated smallpox from the world by intelligent use of vaccines. Now they want mass use, very profitable, continuing, ongoing production and consumption of vaccines.
Yeah. And it sure looks like that's in the future if things keep going the way they're going with the Gates Foundation and the WHO and, wow. So
I looked at the production of flu vaccine in the U.S. over the years, and the historic high production happened to coincide with historic high death rate from flu.
Really?
There's no population evidence of any benefit at all from the flu vaccines. Already in 1976, the guy in charge of flu vaccines in the CDC itself was telling people in the organization that they were basically defrauding the public by claiming there was a benefit, and he got fired.
Yeah. Dr. Ray Peet is with us, a PhD. It is raypeet.com. We're going to tell you how to get his newsletter. Before we start taking some emails, Dr. Peet, I'd like to just dig around in the world of testing and help us to understand. So the test that's currently going on and has been, and we see these huge numbers, you know, hundreds of thousands tested positive. Can you explain to us with your understanding of what this test is actually seen and testing for?
First, the most important thing is that the misuse of tests has been just the basis for the shutdown of the economy. The evidence that anything serious was happening just wasn't there. They had tests that showed the existence of certain types of RNA. Polymerase chain reaction will show a single strand can be amplified and show the presence of the germ, regardless of whether there's enough to have any biological effect. That test will find a trace of it and show its presence. But you need a picture of the population to interpret what that means. If you test only the sick old people with a high probability of dying from any stress, then you can say that the mortality rate is 2.5%, or even in Italy they've been saying it's 8% mortality of the people with the evidence of the infection. But several new studies, like the study of the pregnant child delivering women in New York City, and a study in San Mateo County in California, doing a sample of the population is necessary to interpret whether it has any relation to the disease or to mortality. And in the California study, for example, it looks like this particular virus is no more harmful than the standard flu virus. The standard flu mortality per infection is thought to be about 1 in 1,000. And in the California study, it could be 1.4 in 1,000 instead of the 8 or 10 that people have been scaring the public with. And the people who were giving those scare figures had to have known that their sample was meaningless. They are basically just creating propaganda with numbers that have absolutely no meaning.
So what exactly is the current test showing when you say all the positive?
It's it just shows that there is at least one molecule that has this particular sequence.
I see.
You can grow the particular organism in cells in the lab, then you can use that as a standard and test scrapings from a person's nose, for example, find even one molecule is enough. The person who invented the test said it's outrageous to consider that that can be a quantitative test, because you're turning, you can produce an infinite quantity from a single molecule, part of the problem, that they aren't able to judge whether the presence means anything.
Yes. So is it fair to say it's essentially meaningless?
Some meaning, but about 1% as much meaning as they are implying.
1%. So now they're hearing the term antibody test that's coming. This is what they're working on, and this is going to be a new test that is going to be widely available. Do you have any idea what this is about? Same thing?
That's the same problem with the HIV AIDS virus. They used to say having the antibody is evidence that you're immune. That's the whole basis for the vaccine ideology, that you want to produce the antibody and then you're immune. Mm-hmm. There's no other justification for vaccination. But now they say if you have the antibody, that means you're sick.
Wow. Just the opposite.
There was one study, I think, of five people published in JAMA a few weeks ago, taking a serum from a person who had the positive antibodies and giving it to people with the infection and saying that they saw improvement. That was the traditional serum treatment in the 20s and 30s, giving a germ to a horse and then taking the antibody serum from the horses and treating very sick people with a big dose of antibodies. Even for things like snake bite, it can have a curative effect. But I think the reason it dropped out of use was that the horse blood material can have serious immunological allergenic effects.
But for the most part, it's fair to say that most of all these things are all natural occurrences that are going on in the body all the time.
Andrew Kaufman's thing about the exosomes.
Mm-hmm. Exosomes, right.
That's very important to keep in mind, that we are constantly producing these. For example, they've shown that an injured lung cell can send out specific information in the form of exosomes, particles that contain RNA, DNA, fats and proteins and such are emitted. Clouds of them circulate in the blood. They're so small that for 200 years people discarded them as just irrelevant dust in the background, but with electron microscopes, they can see that they're structured containing nucleic acids, very small particles on the order of the particles that are identified as viruses.
Yeah.
But these, for example, travel in the blood and can signal bone marrow cells, for example, to make specific types of repair cells.
Wow.
Specific for lung repair. This is going on constantly, and for example, a mother's milk contains these exosomes, and they're thought to contain useful information that pass through the wall of the intestine as the baby digests the milk and contribute to the baby's immune system. So it's in the last 20 years or so that they are recognized as a very basic part of biology that was simply passed over. It was described actually by a North Korean in the 1960s, but no one believed him. It was rediscovered when people started using electron microscopes to look at the background material in blood serum. With stress and aging, such large amounts of these enter the blood that they are probably why you can take the blood from an old animal and imitate aging symptoms in young animals, and the serum from young animals and rejuvenate to some extent old animals. So the circulating debris, it's a genetic repair system, ideally, but with aging and stress, it sends such confused signals. It holds cells in the senescent state, keeps them from dying completely and being replaced. It's a kind of deranged repair system that prevents renewal and participates in aging. All organisms have mobile genetic elements. Barbara McClintock eventually got the Nobel Prize for work showing that genes can move around in chromosomes, and under stress in particular. Bacteria, when they develop a genetic ability to become immune to antibiotics, can create a particle like an exosome and pass it through a tube to foreign bacteria that had never experienced the antibiotic and transmit their resistance to other bacteria. So it's something all the way down to bacteria, they can transmit their genetic adaptive material like an exosome. And since mothers can transmit it to their babies, it's probably a feature of all organisms that they're passing back and forth within the species, this defensive material.
And Kaufman has shown very eloquently that the exosomes that you can isolate and then look at, and what they're calling COVID-19 are exactly the same. Exactly.
Really, yeah, there are exosomes that have exactly that kind of structure. Where did viruses originate? They can't evolve by themselves. They have to live in an animal cell.
In a host, right? They have to live.
Yeah. So I think the only valid theory for viruses is that they are a normal, like bacterial immunity transmission of acquired immunity. A mother can pass her immunity to the baby, and probably just by various contacts, we can pass our genetic information within the species. For example, people have demonstrated that a woman's prior husband's DNA can be found in her tissues, even her brain. So we're very well adapted to absorbing, for example, a woman absorbing the semen demonstrably from different husbands incorporates it into her own cell structure. So it's probably something very normal to, like bacteria, improve our immunity. But with aging, for example, our own exosomes can become toxic to ourselves. And I think the harmful virus effect originates when animals are taking up bits of alien DNA from even a different species and finding it isn't helping to repair their system, but actually deranging it.
Alien DNA would be like, what, in a vaccine, or what other ways would they take it in? What other ways would they take it in?
A German geneticist, Walter Dorfler, has demonstrated that you can take DNA from beef, for example, and show that it can be incorporated into the human genome. So what we're eating, we're probably assimilating some of the DNA from carrots and cabbage and milk and beef and so on.
Wow. Fascinating. Stay right there, sir. Wow. Just so interesting. Dr. Ray Peet, PhD, raypeet.com. And we're going to do a quick little break, and then we're going to get into some of your emails, and hopefully we can get to most of them, all of them. We'll see how we do. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. We appreciate your ongoing support. Boyd Haley, Mercury. It's been years since we've talked to Dr. Haley, probably 10 years. He came out with a product that he developed after studying mercury forever, University of Kentucky, called OSR, and it works so well with the helping the body to detox mercury and other metals out of the body that they took it off the market, you know, the boys, the FDA, and he's working now to get it back on, and we're going to talk to him about his experience and when you might be able to get this little thing. Again, I think it's, well, we'll talk to him about it, and also Dr. Stephanie Seneff with some possible connections between glyphosates and this corona thing, whatever it is, and that'll all be happening tomorrow beginning at 9 a.m. Central. Daniel Vitalis talks about his two premier medicinal mushroom products, Shaga and Reishi.
Because Reishi and Shaga are considered not just adaptogens, but they're also considered immunomodulators, they're safe for daily consumption for a lifetime. There's a lot of herbs, as you know, Patrick, a lot of herbs are not that way. So many medicinal herbs are meant to be used for short periods of time. But there are those few that can be used daily forever, and medicinal mushrooms are that way.
So these would be called a tonic
herbs. Yeah, they're essentially tonic, but if we wanted to get even more specific, they're adaptogenic. I feel like we've set a new standard, and it's going to, we raise the bar, but check it out, see where the bar has been risen to.
You can learn more about these great medicinal mushroom products on Daniel's site. Tonic herbs, adaptogens, dual extraction, fruit bodies, and they're tonics and can be used every day. Modulates the immune system. Shaga and Reishi, special Myron Glass from Sir Thrival on OneRadioNetwork.com. The Max Planck Institute talked a great deal about the idea that you don't want to really take anything into your body unless it's from a once-living source. That's why, you know, when you take these, you know, potentially man-made kind of stuff in the lab, they could, you know, they could be an issue. Everything from vitamin C to everything, but that's a whole other subject. But that's pretty curious when you think about it. The Pearl Sim that we promote is from a living source. It's actually from real pearls. I mean, just not mother of pearl, but just real pearls. and they're in a pristine lakes in China, and Dr. Rulin Xu figured out how to kind of pulverize them without ruining the cellular matrix. And pearl has been used for the teeth and for beauty and strength, longevity in thousands of years of Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I can't tell you how many different Ayurvedic herbs I get through my doc, Ayurvedic doctor from India, that has pearl in them. You can put it on your face, you can take it internally, you can brush your teeth with it. It's just a really lovely product. It comes in a powder, and brush your teeth with it. I mean, what you'll see there is like really cool. I mean, it's like, whoa, this is really fun stuff. Makes them look very pearly. It will help actually the bone to grow. If you got a little bit of root showing there above the, you can actually see it. It'll start to grow and fill in. They used pearl as fillings, thousand year Egypt time. That's what they were using for fillings with pearl. Yeah, not mercury or composites or anything like that. Pearl serum, it's on our website. Get two or three containers at one time and really play with it. Take some internally. I think you'll find it's a very, very nice experience. Pearl Sim on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Lenny?
And you live where, Lenny?
We RV in our mobile home. And so listening to your commercial, on, I got the AquaCure. And man, I love that thing so incredibly much. In fact, I wrote to you right when I got it. That was July last year. And you're absolutely correct about the hydration. When you don't drink as much water, and he had mentioned that too, you know, that happened to him, that he was drinking more water when he didn't do it, and I noticed that too, and I came to that same realization that you did. It's like, wait, why am I feel more thirsty?
Yeah, really interesting. Mine was due for a cleaning where you have to empty it and everything, and I just procrastinated and didn't do it for a couple of days, and I was just drinking the regular structured water. And I was drinking a lot more water. And I really thought, wow, that hydrogen-enriched water must hydrate me so much because I don't need to drink as much water. This is really cool technology. Hydration is just one of the many things that it'll do. Check it out. Lifetime warranty. 1 year, no questions asked. Money back. Guarantee if you don't like it, up to a year. Use promo code ONERADIO for a 10% discount. The AquaCure Hydrogen Brown's Gas Machine. You breathe it and you bubble it in the water on OneRadioNetwork.com.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com.
We're talking with PhD Ray Peet, been at it for about 50 years or so. Somebody mentioned, I wanted to just give you a plug for your newsletter, Dr. Peet, that maybe we weren't giving the right... You said go to an email address, but then somebody, let me see if I can find it real quick. Sorry, I should have pulled this up. It was, his email address is supposed to be typed on PayPal rather than just to an email to him. Is that true, or do you know? Oops, I'm sorry. I got to pull up the right thing. Now go ahead and answer it again. Sorry, I had the wrong control up. Is that true?
Information about subscribing, the address is repeatsnewsletter@gmail.com.
Okay, newsletter@gmail.com, and then you'll take it from there.
Yeah.
Okay, repeatsnewsletter@gmail.com. Here's an interesting question for you. let's see, where is it? Oh, here it is. My friend with pulmonary fibrosis sometimes sleeps with oxygen. He doesn't have 100% oxygen coming in through his nasal tube. It gives a little blast of oxygen, but allows him to breathe ambient air around him. Is that sufficient carbon dioxide intake to make the O2 coming through the tube safe?
Did he mention that the product name, Carbogen, is what they call this 5% CO2 mixture? It should be in the container going in. At least 5%, 7% would be okay, but the well-known product is called Carbogen and is only 5%.
Oh, so there's actually a product that people using oxygen, it comes in a tank, or?
Yeah, it's available to hospitals or
I see.
Anyone, probably by prescription, but it's the safe way to take your oxygen, because even if you get more than you need, the carbon dioxide is provided there right to the lung tissue itself. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the fibrosis of the lungs is a very common after effect of this particular virus, because the angiotensin inflammation, it leads right after inflammation, it leads to overproduction of collagen and leaves the lungs fibrous and inefficient. But I've seen people just by using anti-inflammatory things, thyroid, vitamin D, progesterone, and so on, regress and improve their lungs when they were said to have terminal fibrosis of the lungs. And the blockers of the angiotensin receptors, the sartans, they call them, low sartan, for example, in animal experiments, they are seeing evidence of reversal of the fibrosis of the lungs with these and other anti-inflammatory agents. The tissues can repair themselves. A fibrotic heart, for example, years ago they showed it could remove the excess collagen and restore its smaller size and better functioning just by supplementing T3, the active thyroid hormone. But now that the sartans are available, that's probably the should be part of any anti-fibrosis treatment.
Boy, the thyroid is so key, isn't it, in this? We talk so much about it. Wow. Important to have that baby working right, huh, Doc?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Here's an email. Luke Montag, Montagnier, suggests that the SARS-CoV-2 virus came from a lab. He pointed to the presence of elements of HIV in the genome of the coronavirus and elements of the germ of the malaria. He said the characteristics of the new coronavirus could not have arisen naturally. Do you think the presence of the malaria genome is the reason COVID-19 is not a typical respiratory virus and it's more of a blood hemoglobin affliction?
No, I think the hemoglobin thing is secondary to the carbon dioxide is an important agent in making hemoglobin function properly, and lactic acid interferes with that carbon dioxide function, and the hemoglobin all of our tissues actually carbon dioxide chemically combines as a carbamino compound with the hemoglobin and with hormone receptors all through the body. So it's definitely affecting the hemoglobin, but only secondarily to the change of metabolism.
Mm-hmm. This is from Paula in Arizona. She says, I love your shows, especially with Dr. Pete. Could you please ask him, my dentist used a cone beam x-ray and told me I have a cavitation in my jaw from a tooth that was extracted long ago. He said about 95% of all the extractions end up with cavitations if not done properly. I've never had any pain or tenderness or anything from those cavitations, and I really don't want to do any kind of cavitation surgery. Does Dr. Pete, in his opinion, think that I should do something if it's not bothering me?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think the bone, a hole in the bone just means that the damage was done at a stage of growth where you aren't regenerating bone very well. And so it's basically just a structural defect of the bone that doesn't contain any toxic or pathological elements.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is from Connor. On a recent podcast, in reference to the decreasing average age of puberty in women in America. Dr. Pete mentioned that in countries with a robust coconut industry, the average age of puberty in women could be as high as 18. Are there negative effects that accompanies hitting puberty at such a late age?
That was about 40 years ago. And for example, the state of India that used to have an essentially coconut-based economy, they are now, for their own cooking, they're importing things like soybean oil and not getting the benefits of their own coconuts. So I don't think that would hold today.
Wasn't there some kind of connection between the proliferance of soy in the Philippines long ago, and then the kids were just going into puberty very early? Did I dream that or read that, or is there anything to that?
That would be biologically plausible, because animal experiments show that various fractions it can seem to be the proteins of the, for example, tofu, not just the oils, that have estrogen functions, and the anatomy of animals from mothers that are fed soy products, the genitals are shaped according to the estrogen excess in the mother's diet, and then in the diet of the growing males, they'll have feminized genitals.
Does Dr. Pete have any favorite air filters that he recommends that he believes are worth the money?
Favorites of what?
Air filters in the home.
I didn't understand.
Air filters, these machines.
Air filters.
Sure.
I think the electrostatic air ionization machines combined with a filter, the particles are precipitated electrostatically, and at the same time, they're adding some beneficial disinfecting and
ozone. Do they put in some little ozone in there?
Ozone will disinfect, but some of them add a good stream of negatively ionized air, which is has a tonic effect on the lungs.
I see. So electrostatic is one of the keys of the technology you like.
Mm-hmm.
Electrotechnology. Mm-hmm. Fred is in California, wants to know if you would give Dr. Pete's methods, if you go over quickly, determining thyroid health and what those tests are, what the normal range for those tests are.
Broda Barnes relied a lot on the waking temperature, and his book, Hypothyroidism, The Unsuspected Illness, I think it's something everyone, at least in the U.S., should read. I found that in other climates, he was working in a cool Colorado climate. In a hot climate, you have to take the pulse rate into account as well as the temperature, because a warm climate will keep the body temperature up, even in hypothyroid people. And an additional test that is very, very useful, if it's done right, is the Achilles tendon reflex relaxation rate. You kneel on a chair so your toes hang down.
Mm-hmm.
You thump the Achilles tendon to cause the calf muscle to contract, which flings your toes out away from your body. And it's the relaxation rate of this big muscle. It should, if your thyroid is good, it should relax instantly, letting the toes free fall. so that it looks like just a flopping piece of meat. it falls so fast it bounces slightly at the bottom. If you're hypothyroid, the muscle relaxes with visible slowness, like it has a door closer on it, so it carefully comes back to its starting position. Might take a second to fall instead of an invisible fraction of a second. If that's done right, you can see I've given people a quick-acting thyroid after seeing a two-second return of the foot. 30 minutes after taking quick-acting thyroid, they'll have a bouncy, quick reflex.
So let's see if I... So you're kneeling, and the Achilles, I guess, is just in the back. I'm not too sure anatomically savvy here. It's just the back there, the Achilles tendon, right?
And your heel connection to your calf muscle.
To your calf muscle. And you bang... How do you bang on it? You just...
With a soft, heavy object like... could be the back of a book,
mm-hmm.
or the wooden handle of a hammer, something round and firm.
And that will generally just kind of...
You just thump it enough so that the muscle senses the twitch.
Okay.
And it makes a slight jerk. Some people have such tense muscles from hypothyroidism that it looks like a piece of rubber. You see a mechanical... quiver from the bouncing of the thump on the tendon. If you give them thyroid, they'll get relaxed enough that then you'll see the twitch and the slow return.
So there's such a thing as a quick-acting thyroid? What is that?
That's Cytomel.
Oh, T3. Cytomel, we've talked about, you can get from Mexico. Is that's pure T3?
And 5 micrograms of that, or 10 micrograms, typically will relieve all of the most obvious hypothyroid signs and symptoms in 10 or 15 minutes.
Interesting.
If you chew it up.
If you did 10 or 5 or 10 micrograms of this Cytomel that you've talked about, and could you take it to kind of see what happens in 15 minutes to see if you were hypo? What would happen?
If you have like cold hands.
Okay.
My experience that convinced me how fast it was when I was taking only a big dose of T3 in the morning, it has such a short half-life that I was becoming extremely hypothyroid by sunset, and my heart would begin pausing for about 2 seconds several times a minute, and sometimes it would go as long as 3 or 4 seconds pausing, and that was disturbing me. So when it was happening, I quickly put a 10 microgram piece in my mouth and bit it, chewed it up, and before I could finish completely swallowing it, probably 15 seconds, my heart rhythm had leveled out. And I never went that long without the T4 keeps you from having those withdrawal reactions. T4 backs up the T3 and keeps your body producing it.
Hmm. So if you had cold hands and feet and did a little bit of the T3 and it warmed up, it would be an indication that you're hypothyroid. Well, that's curious. I wonder what Dr. Pete recommends for a toothpaste, or if he thinks that the amount of fluoride in the standard products, most of them have them, can affect the thyroid.
Theoretically, at least. I've never seen a demonstration that it happens, but that much fluoride. For example, the amount in fluoridated water, if you're using Cytomel as a major supplement, which I was doing for a while, I found that when I was in San Francisco and would have some fluoridated water with my orange juice, that my T3 was completely inactive after doing that for several days. That amount of fluoride will interact with any T3 it comes in contact with, but probably there's not enough from toothpaste or from the water that gets into your circulation that it can have such a strong effect on your normally produced T3, because we produce a good part of our T3 locally in each cell, and so it just doesn't have much opportunity to be inactivated by supplemented fluoride.
Fascinating. Let's go to this call. Good morning. Who's this, please?
This is Mo from Fort Worth, Texas.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air with Dr. Pete.
Yeah, Dr. Pete, I talked to you last month about my TSH being 0.1, and you said to check the T3 and the calcium and the sodium, and I had a blood test done, and my free T3, free T3 is 3, free T4 is 1, TSH is 7.4, my calcium is 9.4,
okay,
carbon dioxide is 26.
Let's see. We can't go into all this kind of detail and have them kind of do a diagnosis on the air. What's your main question, dear?
I still don't feel good.
You still don't feel good. Can you give us some ideas? You know, we can't do this kind of...
With the TSH so high, I think you should talk to your doctor about that. That's an abnormally high number.
You want to get
What should it be?
The normal range is usually 0.3 or 0.5 or something like that, up to a maximum of sometimes they say 3.0 or 5.0 even.
Hmm.
But 7 is definitely outside the range.
Can you talk to your doctor, ma'am, and see if you can get that TSH down?
So what should I be taking more of, T3 or T4 to bring it down?
T4 is the one usually prescribed for bringing it down.
Yeah, she's given me 25 micrograms twice a day.
If you're taking that and still having such high T4, it used to be common to prescribe 100 micrograms of T4 per day, all the way up to 200 or 300 micrograms, according to how much it takes to bring your TSH into the normal range.
Okay, I'm going to talk to her. She said to wait 6 weeks, and then she's going to do the blood test again.
Yeah. Well, good. Stay on top of it. Thanks. Thanks for trying.
All right.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Calling. Thanks for calling. Is it true, writes an emailer from Roger, that the PCR test is only a diagnosis of inflammation?
No, I think it actually finds the presence of that RNA. That doesn't necessarily correspond to inflammation. The people with inflammation are the ones that are going to get sick with the virus. But people without pre-existing inflammation are basically already immune to it.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Monica. I was wondering if hormone imbalance, mainly lack of progesterone, and infrequent heavy bleeding could be caused by just anemia. I did order some progesterone oil. How long do you usually take it to see any difference?
Frequent periods or heavy periods usually mean a deficient thyroid function, and the thyroid is required to make adequate progesterone, and to remove estrogen. And so when you're low thyroid, you can't produce enough progesterone to have a full monthly cycle, and so it has repeated small cycles. And the TSH will usually be high. Prolactin tends to go up in hypothyroidism, so having both TSH and prolactin tested would probably show something.
Dr. Ray Pete is with us here on the third Monday at 10:30 Central Time. My name is Varma. I'm from India. Hi, Varma. I really enjoy your show when you have Dr. Pete on. A couple of quick questions, if you will, please. What does he think would be the best way to take care of seasonal flu once infected?
It's never too late to correct a vitamin D deficiency, and that usually makes you susceptible to an annual flu or cold. But all of the anti-inflammatory things, aspirin, chicken soup, progesterone in cycle, and normalizing your thyroid, keeping your blood sugar up, making sure you're getting enough protein.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about this nixtamalization, and you turned me on to this place. What's the name of it? Is it that has the nixtamalized corn grits? What? What's the name of that company?
I get mine from an Oregon company, Three Sisters.
Oh.
But there are several companies that make good grits and
grits.
And masa.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I'll get the name for you folks. And boy, I really enjoy those. Those are good for you, right? And they've been soaked in lye and everything, so the body really can digest these guys, right?
They don't have the toxic effects of plain corn. Much of the polyunsaturated fatty acids have been removed, and the niacin content has been increased, and the leucine has been effectively detoxified.
Wow.
Very digestible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... I'll get you guys the name of this place. You can buy 1 pound or 10 pound, and the only challenge I'm having with them, it's kind of dumb, but they sure tend to stick to the bottom of my glass cookware thing. But that's about it. You know, other than that, they're just yum. Do you have any special ways to do that without them sticking?
No.
No. They do stick though, don't they? For some reason.
Yeah. When I heat a tortilla in the microwave, it's I think the predigested effect of the lime treatment makes them when you heat them very glue-like.
Here's a question on the nixtamalization process. Can you do this on wheat berries? And if you do, what happens to the phytic acid and gluten? Does it eliminate those?
Oh, it breaks down the gluten.
Wow.
An important part of it. And other grains, it works apparently with any grain. People have shown me pictures of the things they make with different grains. And there are toxic proteins in storage proteins, similar to gluten, even in the grains that contain no gluten as such, but they're still toxic and are broken down by the digestive lime process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could get some of the Einkorn wheat, from Italy, the real ancient grains, and soak those guys and grind them up for bread. I bet they'd be good.
I think it improves the flavor as well as the nutritional value.
Yeah. But it's interesting because you spent time in Central America, they just kind of do this traditionally with corn because they just kind of figured it out, I guess, over thousands of years when they've been eating corn.
And when the U.S. imported corn or adopted it from the Indians. They didn't adopt the lime process, and so pellagra, when people ate too much corn and not enough protein, they developed pellagra as a result, which wasn't known all through the traditional American cultures because of the process producing adequate niacin.
So what is pellagra? I mean,
it's a niacin deficiency.
And that'll...
But it tends to go with the protein deficiency because if you eat a lot of protein, you can make your own niacin.
Here's a great question. Patrick says he likes popcorn from time to time. Can you use the nixtamalization process on the corn kernels before you pop them?
They won't pop.
They won't pop. So we just got to go with it. They won't pop. I guess you've tried that, right? Here's an email. Does GABA cross the blood-brain barrier? And if so, is it safe to supplement with GABA? GABA.
It only crosses the barrier when the brain needs it. In a very stressed organism, they find that it will go across the blood-brain barrier because the barrier relaxes in an exhausted brain that needs GABA.
Here's one for you. Is it safe to use iodine topically?
2% tincture is safe, but you don't want to cover too much skin, because if you do that every day, covering a lot of skin, you will absorb enough to derange your thyroid function. But just for disinfecting a wound, it's very safe to use a 2% tincture.
Mm-hmm. Here's one for you. Which supplements and topical agents break down any calcification within the layers of the skin that contribute to hair loss and the formation of wrinkles? What supplements and topical?
Related to calcium, there is the effect of parathyroid hormone. When your diet is deficient in calcium and vitamin K, the parathyroid hormone increases and knocks out oxidative metabolism, and it's a known factor in hair loss to have an excess of parathyroid hormone. Probably, in general, tissue deterioration, which would be behind wrinkles. When the energy goes down, collagen is overproduced and makes the tissue lose elasticity.
Here's interesting. Dr. Pete, is there a healthy or ideal percentage or ratio of body fat for women? And would that percentage ratio want to change with age?
It shouldn't rise. Normally, when your progesterone and thyroid fall in the late 30s to early 40s, the metabolism slows down and starts depositing too much fat. So you should try to keep your thyroid and progesterone level in balance with the other hormones. That will maintain the normal feminine balance of subcutaneous fat, well distributed around the hips and thighs, especially. And because of that normal female balance, which is there as reserve for pregnancy to maintain a steady metabolism just by functioning as a reservoir. The fat should stay mainly close to the skin and not accumulate around the abdomen, torso, back, and face. Stress shifts it into those positions, both in men and women. But women normally do have a much higher percentage than men, even when they're healthy and athletic, and they shouldn't try to compete with men for a low fat percentage. Hmm.
We've received some emails earlier this morning, and somehow the Dr. Kaufman, the latest one he released yesterday, called The Rooster in the River of Rats, was blocked, and I didn't know it, but we were able to fix it, and it's back up on YouTube. So whatever happened, it was a weird thing, and it was only blocked for a short time. So Sharon was able to get it going again, but and then I just found it on YouTube. So, you know, not sure what's going on there. But it's working now. Here's a lady, Amy's in San Diego, and she says, I still have digestive problems and eat very well-cooked and real good foods, yet still have digestive challenge. Can Dr. P recommend, say, digestive enzymes to ingest? Is there any without fillers? He would suggest eating lots of fresh ripe pineapple or other foods instead.
Those kiwi and pineapple do have proteolytic enzymes. It's best to correct your hormones, especially your thyroid, so that your digestive system has the proper enough energy to make the digestive juices and enzymes and to have peristalsis active and coordinated. But those do accelerate the breakdown of proteins. But most of the enzymes on the market are derived from fungus. The traditional digestive enzyme was dried and powdered pancreas, usually pork. And the problem is that you can't cook it and still have enzyme action. And so there's the risk of bacterial or parasite infection from live animal enzymes. And so that was used as an argument for using the fungal enzymes. But a lot of people are allergic to trace fungal antigens that can cause allergic reactions.
So a lot of the enzymes, Doc, we can look at them, they say like protease, amylase, blah, blah, blah. Do we need to know where those are sourced from before taking them?
Yeah. If they're from Aspergillus, you should be cautious. They might contain allergens.
But if they're not Aspergillus, they would be pretty okay, generally?
I think the pig pancreas or beef pancreas is safe. But there is the risk of bacterial infection.
Mm-hmm. Here's a good one. With all the talk these days, could there be a possible natural remedy to heal any ill effects if we were forced to get vaccinated or chipped? I mean this with deep respect, for all should be allowed to properly educate, and then one can make their own choice. But what could we do if we were forced?
I mentioned the accumulating sort of a storm of exosomes that accounts for many of the problems of aging. Those develop from our reactions to stress and exposure to antigens. And so the adjuvant that makes the a vaccine effective is designed to create systemic inflammation. And that systemic inflammation always has its consequences downstream. Robert Kennedy's website has a good access to information on the consequences to national health corresponding to the tremendous increase in exposure to these vaccine adjuvants.
We recently had his great interview, I think it was on RT, Robert Kennedy, and at the end of it, Dr. Pete, he said something I thought was fascinating. He said, you know, people call me an anti-vaxxer, and he said, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. He said, I'm for safe vaccines, and if somebody can show me a legitimate, well-structured test to show me that vaccinated kids are healthier than unvaccinated kids, he said, I'll just go on to other things and work on pollution in the rivers, which is my real passion.
Right.
There's never been a real safe and effective test, has there, for vaccines?
No, the safety tests are very often fraudulent, meant to deceive. But my position is smallpox vaccine was used intelligently over a period of 10 years. That was all it took to eliminate smallpox from the world.
Huh. When was that? What years were that? Excuse me for interrupting. What year?
From the 60s until, I think, about 1970.
Really?
Early 70s.
And were they giving just a little bit of smallpox without any kind of mercury and stuff? Or?
No, they would see an outbreak somewhere in the world, and they would send a team in and close in, encircle that outbreak, and vaccinate only the people who were likely to be exposed to it. And it only took doing that several times, and they caught the last of the germs, and they were eliminated forever.
Really? Wow.
That definitely isn't good business, because there were no more sales of smallpox vaccine.
Sure. Yeah. Are you concerned as a health educator about all this talk about, you know, Bill Gates and want to have certificates to prove that you're vaccinated and they're going to come out with some vaccine soon? I mean...
I've seen several very good videos that I think are background for the talk of pushing vaccination on the basis of this so-called pandemic. Two Stanford associated professors, John Ioannidis and Jay Bhattacharya, both of them have very good videos showing the actual facts of the pandemic. And there is a thing called the Corbett Report.
Yes.
I had never seen that before, but he has an episode called Foreknowledge of the Plandemic, and it's very interesting on the financial background of the origin of the panic. The absence of real evidence of any reason to panic, it takes on new meaning in the financial events of late 2019.
There was a report that the Rockefeller Foundation put out in 10 years ago, and we're going to actually copy four or five pages from a PDF from this report, and they talk about this entire thing, and it's like they've written it for today, Dr. Pete. Just fascinating, yeah.
Mentioning the Rockefeller Foundation, there's a professor formerly of that of the university, Knut Witkowski, has a video on this current situation.
Yeah. So what were the other two names you mentioned? If folks want to do some research about the videos you said, the two names, you said them rather quickly. What were those?
John Ioannidis, Ioannidis.
Okay.
Jay Bhattacharya, Bhattacharya.
And they have some interesting things to share about this whole pandemic.
Very good stuff.
Well, Dr. Pete, as always, it's such an honor to have you here. Thanks for spending some time with us from Northern Oregon. And you're saying that they're starting to get back things? They're starting to move a little bit?
The stores are working again.
Oh, they are? Huh. Yeah, Texas is starting to open up, and I think Ohio, Michigan, and some places. So we may be over the hump here. But it's very interesting, even from the financial side, and the CDC side and WHO, they're already kind of laying the groundwork for a rebound for the fall. Have you kind of seen some of this already?
People should start looking at the real figures being published by the CDC, for example.
Yes, sir.
Even though they send out instructions to doctors to in making autopsy or death certificates, if they didn't know what the cause was, it was okay to guess if it seemed likely that they might have died of the virus, to put that down as the cause of death.
Yes, sir.
But even with instructions like that, the actual figures of flu and coronavirus mortality, they're much less scary looking when you look at
the real numbers.
The actual numbers, but the public warnings and statements about wearing masks and so on, that really seems designed to create panic.
Yes, sir. We put it on our Facebook page. I have it here in front of me. This is NCHS, CDC, as of April 17th. Since February 1st through, that's 2.5 months total COVID deaths, 13,000. That's it.
And the typical annual flu-like illness.
What is it, 60,000 a year or something like that?
Up to 68,000, I think, was their high year. Mm-hmm. And this year is, I think the total is well under that average flu death.
Right, year. So if you go 60,000, just say 65,000 just for fun and divide it by 12, and that gives 5,540 times 2.5 months, which is what this CDC report, right? It's 13,850. Wow. And they're saying 13,130. So, okay.
The mortality is normally higher in winter in northern countries. Mm-hmm. So about 3 million people normally die of all causes during the 4 months of flu season, and of those, a few tens of thousands die with the flu or because of the flu. In previous years, they didn't have millions of tests for the coronavirus, but this year they do have tests for that. But if you look at the total number of respiratory disease deaths, The total number is very moderate, but since they're providing vast numbers of tests for that particular virus, it's logical that it would seem that more people are dying from that than from the old-fashioned flu.
Yes, sir. Yeah, even so-called enlightened websites are posting things like 40,000 deaths in the United States. Fauci, a big headline this morning, he's condemning protesters. Second wave fears. They're already building for this second wave. So be cautious, stay alert, stay awake. Dr. Pete, it's an honor to have you here, sir. Thanks for being here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
RayPete.com. And again, the email address to learn about your newsletter?
Oh, Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com.
Ray Pete's plural newsletter at gmail.com. Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Bye. Well, nothing is as it seems. Be careful. If you have a television, I'd cut that cable. Well, okay. Well, we'll see you tomorrow. We're going to have a fun show. We're going to talk to Dr. Boyd Haley, who's a real mercury monster, and I say that in a good way. He knows a lot about mercury. And then also Dr. Stephanie Seneff will be here tomorrow. So we're going to do a couple shows tomorrow, Tuesday, or regular day off. But that's okay. I'm here for you. My job is to help you in any way I can to support you in reaching your goals, no matter what they are. That's what I'm here for you, and Sharon's here backing me up, and without her, I would be like in La La Land. So thank you, Sharon. So I love you all very much. Thanks for your ongoing support. If I can help in any way, email me, Patrick, at OneRadioNetwork.com. We'll be live here in the morning with Dr. Boyd Haley. Take care of yourself. May the blessings be.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com.